What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. John, I hope you're having a wonderful day.
I am. It's not raining.
No, it's not. It's really nice outside, a little hot. But I will say that there are people out there who probably are having a wonderful day because they anticipate that a law that has been put forward called the Right to Try Law is going to give them the opportunity, and they're very hopeful about it, to extend their life if they're having very difficult times because of a terminal illness. And, you know, it's wonderful for people to have hope and expectation, John, but I just hope that they're not being oversold about the potential for this Right to Try Act.
Well, I am very skeptical about this because I've seen in the past where they've brought through the regular regiment, drugs through, and then they find out later that there's unintended consequences that they had to either take them off the market or change them somehow. But so I'm very skeptical of
this. One of the things I think you and I have seen and heard is how rigorous many of the standards are to get something to market, and that's one of the reasons many of our drugs are so costly. And so what do we sacrifice in that process if we're looking for shortcuts? Do we say, well, you know, you're going to be a guinea pig in this? And there are many people, John, who are willing to be guinea pigs because they've lost all hope. We do understand that.
Right, right. No, I agree that if maybe there's a slim chance that it may help you, maybe it's good to be a guinea pig in that case.
However, this is the United States, John, and I've always used the terminology, nothing sells like excess in America, and there's nothing like the carnival barker in us. We are amazing that way, from P.T. Barnum to, well, let me read the quote that is meant to give us assurance that this is all going to work so well. And then I'll tell you who said it. We will be saving, I don't even want to say thousands, because I think it's going to be much more, thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands. So this person went from thousands to thousands to hundreds of thousands in the course of about 3 seconds. We're going to be saving tremendous numbers of lives. And given the predilection of the individual who said this, it wouldn't be long if he went on and on where he was talking about millions of lives. And it's none other than President Donald Trump.
Oh, I thought you were talking about, who was that said billions?
Oh, Carl Sagan. But, you know, he's been proven out, John, because we have found billions and billions of stars. And McDonald's has sold billions and billions of hamburgers.
That's true.
Well, President Trump, speaking at the signing of the Right to Try legislation several months ago, telling us this is going to be phenomenal. But he's told us that everything he's done is the first time it's been done, that we've never had so many jobs, and we've never had this, that, and the other. So he is the master of hyperbole. And I don't like hyperbole in this case, because I don't want people's expectations to be dashed. The individuals we're talking about here have probably tried all kinds of protocols. They have done everything that is humanly possible to extend their lives. And now they're given hope once again. Is this just another placebo? I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder that too. But I mean, as long as they know going in that, hey, you know, this is untried, you know, it seems to have good results, but, you know, I guess it's okay, but it's kind of scary, I think.
Well, I'll tell you, we're going to get a very sanguine view of what this all means from Dr. She has a PhD, and she's also got a master's in public health, a remarkable woman, Allison Bateman House. And she's an assistant professor in the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. And I really want to hear from her ethically, philosophically, and practically speaking, whether Right to Try is going to give people true opportunity for hope, or whether, once again, they're being oversold with a promise that, well, no one's really going to keep. So let's listen to Dr. Bateman House today on America Trends.
The held belief is that America's approval process for new drugs is long and arduous. Is that true?
In general, yes. The process to develop a new drug in the United States takes multiple years. I'm going to say on average around 7, probably, depending on what type of drug it is. And it's very expensive. The question is that any different from how it is in the rest of the world? And I don't claim to be an expert on this, but I believe that the FDA is comparable, if not speedier, than most other worldwide regulatory agencies.
Oh, really? Because we got the sense that people were going to Europe and other places, and they were given quicker, you know, access to some things that perhaps were not available in the United States.
And there are also many, many, many people from around the world coming to the United States to get access to things that are not available in their country. So it's a two-way street. There are always some things that are approved outside of the United States first. There are many things. The United States is the primary nation in which approval happens for the vast majority of drugs.
Yeah, and I was wondering about that. I mean, do we know a percentage? Because we think that as it relates to medical innovation, that we've cornered the market on a lot of remarkable changes, though we still haven't figured out how to cost a lot of things and how to deliver various services efficiently and inexpensively, that when it comes to innovation as it relates to drugs and other therapies, that we're kind of way ahead of the rest of the world. Is that a fair assumption or an American overstatement?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, when a drug is approved in the United States, that doesn't necessarily mean that all the testing took place in the United States, especially for indications that are not common in the United States, say, you know, malaria or certain types of infectious diseases that are basically eradicated in the United States. Drug companies have to go to other parts of the world to do their trials, and then they end up bringing that data back to the FDA. So it's more of a global system than we would think. Mm-hmm. The reason that the United States really does have such a paramount role to play in the pharmaceutical industry is because, A, the FDA is considered globally as the preeminent regulatory agency in terms of doing a good job, doing it fast, and very willing to be novel and innovative in terms of how it evaluates drugs. So many other regulatory agencies look to the FDA as a guide, and in fact, there are other countries that say, you know what, if it's FDA approved, we don't even need to do our own evaluation. That's good enough for us. So it's the role of the FDA that really makes the U.S. so important in this particular area. And the other thing is the United States is just a huge market with regard to companies wanting to sell their products here. You know, we may not have the most people out of all nations in the world, but we're pretty populous. And unlike many nations in the world, we don't have a national body that bargains down prices for the entire country. Companies are able to make more of a profit in the United States, which makes it very appealing to companies to get their drug approved on the market here and to go ahead and do it first. So the U.S. is a huge factor for the pharmaceutical industry.
This Right to Try legislation that people have begun talking about on a federal level, many states already have it, red states, blue states. It really hasn't been that much of an issue, whether it's a more liberal or conservative state. But how important is it that this Right to Try legislation is now being adopted federally?
Well, I guess I would ask, important in what sense? Important in terms of patients getting access to drugs as
yes.
they wish? I think it's going to be very unimportant. I think it is much more of a policy that sounds good and it appeals to people at a sort of basic level than a policy that's actually going to cause any changes in access to drug. What I do think the policy federal level is going to do is set Well, several things. I think it's going to cause more headaches for many pharmaceutical and biotech companies that now will have to deal with not one but two regulatory pathways to do annual reports on and all that. I think it's going to cause lots of confusion for doctors, patients, patient advocacy groups, insurance companies, and all the other players that are going to have to try to deal with the impact of having two simultaneous pathways for how to get access to investigational drugs outside of clinical trials. And I think on a longer term basis, it sets a very unfortunate precedent for rolling back power from the FDA. And I can only but imagine that there will be future attempts to do that using this as a precedent.
Well, let's go back to make certain that someone listening to this understands what this really will do. I mean, if in the past you went to the FDA and you sought compassionate use or some of these expanded access policies that they have put into place, that's one thing. But the right to try legislation, what does that add to the mix?
It adds nothing. What it does is it takes away what is being portrayed as one obstacle in that more traditional route of access. So I think the easiest way to explain this is to go through what is the traditional route of access and then what gets removed under right to try.
Yeah, perfect.
So the traditional route of access is either a doctor comes up with the idea of, I would like to treat Mrs. Jones with an investigational product, or Mrs. Jones herself may come up with the idea. She sees mention of a drug on social media post or on TV or in a newspaper and goes, well, you know, I might be able to use that. Regardless of whether it starts with the patient or whether it starts with the doctor, you end up having this dyad that is united in agreement that, yes, this doctor and this patient together are going to try to seek access. Now, to seek access, unfortunately, there's no one-stop shop. There's no Amazon that you can just go on and say, oh, great, here are all the investigational drugs in the world, and this is the one I want to try. You have to figure out what company manufactures that drug, which is not always the simplest thing, and then you have to figure out how to contact that company and ask the company for access to the drug. It is 100% the company's prerogative to say no or yes. You cannot sue them. You cannot do anything if you don't get the answer you want, except publicly shame the company, which is why we see these social media campaigns where someone says, you know, my wife is dying or my mother's dying, and, you know, company X won't give her access to a potentially life-saving drug. But, so let's assume for a second you have a doctor who's willing, you have a patient who's willing, and you have a drug company that's willing. At that point, you go to the FDA, you fill out a one-page, seven-question form.
It is, that's it?
That's it.
Yeah.
It is reviewed by the FDA. If it is an emergency request, it is reviewed same day. If it is not an emergency request, on average, it takes about 3 days to get a response from the FDA. And this is not just a yes or no. This is the FDA staff actually looking over the proposed use of the drug and helping to write out a treatment plan. So they may tweak how often the drug will be given, what sort of precautions are taking at the same time, what dosage of the drug, et cetera, based on their knowledge of both the investigational drug and other drugs similar to it. At that point, once you have all of that, the treating doctor has to go to their employer, whether it's a hospital or a healthcare system or whatnot, and get approval from an institutional body. Once all those things happen, the patient can be treated. And keep in mind that because it's an investigational drug, you know, being treated is not necessarily being helped. It may do nothing, and it could actually cause harm, which is why there are so many sort of checks and balances to make sure that nobody gets overly optimistic and just willy-nilly uses drugs in a way that could hurt the person and in some cases even hasten death or cause it to be more painful. Now, right to try.
Okay, so that's the old process. Now the new process that you can undertake federally. And when does this go into effect?
Well, the law has been passed, so technically it is in effect right now. The problem is anytime a law is created, somebody has to translate, you know, that sort of vague language of the law into rules of the road for everyone to follow. That has not yet happened.
So the regulations have not been put forward.
Right. My prediction is it'll be maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months. The problem here is that normally what would happen is the FDA, since it's the one that deals with investigational drugs, would be the one to do that sort of translation from law to regulation. And in this case, the bill's sponsor, Ron Johnson, who was chief in getting Right to Try passed, actually sent a very angry letter saying the whole point of this bill was to take power away from the FDA, and he did not want the FDA doing this sort of translation process. So if there's no translation process, no one's ever going to be able to use this because there are too many open questions. So we have sort of an odd situation, and I will just have to wait and see, like everyone else, how it plays out.
But broadly speaking, in terms of the parameters of the legislation, without having the detail to underpin it, what is the intent, and what would it help someone forego in the process that you earlier enumerated?
So in the traditional process that I articulated called expanded access, there is a belief, unfounded by data, that the thing that is keeping people from getting access to investigational drugs that they want to try outside of a clinical trial is the FDA. People say the paperwork is too long. They say that it takes too long to get a response from the FDA. The FDA has been portrayed as a roadblock. So the purpose of this new pathway was to come up with a pathway that did not involve the FDA. And so in answer to your earlier question about, you know, what does Right to Try entail, the exact process that I just went through, you have to have the patient, you have to have the doctor, you have to have the willing drug company. You do not have to have the FDA. That's the one part that's cut out. You still have to have the institutional approval. So it is the exact same process. Everything is still the same. It's just the FDA part is gone.
But what about the liability to the company if something goes amiss? At least they had the cover of the FDA prior to this.
Which is why I predict that this is not actually going to result in any changes. I can't think of a single company that would have any desire to give its investigational drug out to a person who is ill, too ill or otherwise unable to join a clinical trial, as a matter of fact, and do this without the FDA's prior approval. It just seems, you know, to use a highly technical term, a incredibly stupid business decision.
Now, in the 36, I think it is, states that have passed this, what is the experience?
In all but one of them, we find no signs of it having been used, and that is despite efforts. So I guess I should interrupt myself and say who I am and how I come to this topic. So as you said, I'm Allison Batemanhouse. I'm a professor of medical ethics at NYU Langone Medical School, but I co-chair an international working group on access to investigational medicines. We predate the creation of Right to Try laws, and so we were not founded in either to promote them or to damn them. They kind of came along as we were already doing our work, but obviously being in the space in which we work, we were very interested to see the effect that these laws, as they started passing on the state level, had on patients' access to investigational drugs. The first state law passed in, I believe, 2014 in Colorado. Again, as you mentioned earlier, on a bipartisan basis, it was signed into law by a Democratic governor. But we can find no evidence of any of these laws being used anywhere except for Texas.
And why in Texas?
I don't know why in Texas, but I can tell you about the two instances we are aware of in
sure.
Texas. There is a man named Stanley Brzezinski. There's been numerous portrayals of him, so I'll let your listeners Google him and learn about him themselves. But basically, he claims to be able to treat a fatal brain cancer in children that other people have been unable to treat, and some people think that he is a hero, and some people think he's a complete fraud. He has said that he is treating people under right to try with this investigational product that he has created himself. The other person to use this is a doctor named Dr. Delpathon, who, you know, seemed to be a reputable doctor with a good background and academic standing. So the question that naturally came to my group's mind is, why would this doctor be using right to try when no one else was? And the long answer made very short is apparently the FDA stopped him from being able to treat patients, so he decided to try to use this alternate path to treat patients with an investigational product. Those patients could have gone to other doctors and been treated with the exact same product under expanded access, but if they stayed with him because he was not being allowed to treat patients anymore via expanded access by the FDA, he had to use right to try.
When we look at the other potential downsides, what about rushing the process? Will companies now, thinking that perhaps people have a direct pipeline to them, start moving things out more quickly and some of the requisite amount of testing may not be done?
No, I don't think that. You know, as we mentioned earlier, bringing a drug to market is an incredibly time-consuming and expensive product. No company is going to rush it because they would just be setting themselves up for financial failure and a business, you know, disaster. So no, I don't think that's going to happen. What I think is going to happen is, unfortunately, I think people are going to believe, patients are going to believe, based on the language of this bill, right to try, mm-hmm. that they actually do have a right to drugs. I think patients who otherwise may not have known that they could request access to investigational drugs are now going to request access. And I anticipate most companies are still going to continue to use the expanded access pathway to evaluate those requests. I would imagine patients are not going to have any idea whether it's right to try or expanded access is being used to evaluate their requests, because it's not something that they are a part of. They have their doctor put in the request, and then they're not involved again until they get a yes or a no, you know, and a come to the hospital because we're going to schedule this. So I think that there's going to be a lot of behind-the-scenes commotion as people try to figure out how to respond to probably an increase in the number of requests and also definitely an increase in the amount of confusion. But I don't think it's going to result in more people getting access.
I read another expert suggesting that he's worried that there's going to be a bunch of shady actors that are going to pop up, that are going to try to start to take advantage of the right to try law, saying we can provide these sort of experimental therapies, if you want to call them that, to patients without needing to go through the FDA. Well, America has been known for certain shady characters getting into different spaces when not regulated. What do you think?
I am completely sympathetic to the fact that this, you know, removes a safeguard against shady actors, not only shady drug companies, but shady doctors. I share that concern. That being said, I want to, you know, let your listeners know that they should not run in panic to the hills yet, because there are some basic precautions in this law that, whereas I find them completely insufficient, means that it's not 100% a Wild West. So, for example, for a person to be eligible to use a product under right to try, that product has to have received something called an IND, which is a, I guess, an authorization from the FDA to be used in human subjects. It does not mean that the product is safe. It does not mean that the product is helpful, but it means that it at least is not something you cooked up in your bathtub. You know, you submitted to the FDA, you know, the chemical composition and other such things. And, you know, anything just completely, here's another technical term, wacko, would not be given that IND, you know, designation. So do I still think that people could use their IND-approved product to cause harm? Yes, that's what I would say Stanley Brzezinski is doing in Texas, in my personal opinion. His product was able to get an IND, but it also, it means that the average, you know, person on the street corner who has no idea how to get an IND or you know, the persistence and the time to go through that process, it was not going to be able to start vending their product.
Well, again, one of the concerns that was raised is that perhaps we're beginning to see some of these concerns play out in stem cell clinics that are popping up around the country to try to provide stem cell treatments for a host of problems, eye problems, heart problems. Is there a particular area of practice that you're most concerned about, if you are?
Stem cells has been a problem for years, and whereas when I first started this project, you know, I never would have billed myself as the largest defender of the FDA. Through the process of doing this work, and especially in contemplating what Right to Try would bring about with the reduction of the FDA's role, I now do claim the title self-imposed of, you know, FDA's biggest supporter. That being said, I will say the FDA has done an abysmal job in the stem cell world. They have let fraudulent practices run amok without any interference. They've done just a horrible job protecting patients, and I think that it's only going to get worse.
Now, President Trump, he claimed that this new law allowing access to these drugs would save hundreds of thousands of lives. Where did he come up with that?
I don't know. I wasn't there, but I think we've seen that he is fond of hyperbole, and I think that this is another example of presidential hyperbole. I'm sure he was told that this law would save lives, because that's what proponents have said the entire time. But I mean, I think that even the most optimistic estimates are nowhere near that number. Just to give you an example, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but somewhere just below 2,000 requests each year come in for expanded access. Now, that does not tell us how many patients are seeking it, because some requests are for a single patient and some requests are for groups of patients, and it could be anywhere from two patients to, you know, thousands of patients. So there's no direct correlation between the number of requests that come into the FDA for expanded access and the number of patients treated. But because this is what I call a fact-free environment, there is no reporting required of the number of requests that companies get. There's no reporting of the number of requests that companies agree to provide, and there's no reporting of how many of these proposals actually are carried out. So in lack of numbers all over the place, the best estimate we have of the interest is this number of FDA reviews. And again, as I said, we can't extrapolate from that directly to number of patients, because sometimes the reviews are for more than one patient. But even so, even if you took the most optimistic read and said maybe half of those requests were for two or more patients, you're just not going to get the sort of numbers he's talking about.
When we look at the internet and the impact that information traveling as quickly as it does without certain backups and safeguards, and we see this even in the realm of journalism and fake news, are you concerned about what is going to be expressed on the internet, giving people false hope?
Let me answer that in a roundabout way. I think that the Right to Try conversation has had two parts. There's a Right to Try law, which I find misguided and would have preferred it never passed, and I think is going to cause harm. But there is a Right to Try movement, and this is the movement of people saying, you know, the status quo is not working for us, and we need to be able to get access to patients who want to try an investigational drug. And I'm very sympathetic to that idea, the movement's idea, because there are problems. I'm not a Pollyanna and say everything's perfect. There are numerous problems that need fixing. What I would love to have happen is, out of this movement and the law, is to at least have educated people that access is possible, to have educated doctors about this is what to do when you get this request, and to have educated companies about, hey, it's likely that at some point you are going to get a request. Why don't you go ahead and think about it proactively and come up with a policy ahead of time instead of, you know, going into a defensive crouch and not responding at all when you do get that first request. So I think there's some good that can come out of this. I think there's also some ill that will come out of this, and I'm sure there will be people who get false hope, but I think there are also people who will get real hope, because even if it was on the back of a law that I think is bad, they somehow got steered in the direction to good information and access.
Dr. Allison Bateman House, Assistant Professor in the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. And as she had indicated, she's also the chairperson or deputy chairperson of the Compassionate Use Advisory Committee. I thank you so much for being with us today as we try to unravel this right to try legislation here on America Trends.
Thank you.